Lecture 11, The Battle of Thermopylae.
The Athenian victory at Marathon, the subject of our last lecture, was only the beginning of Greco-Persian antagonism. In this lecture, we review the start of the second round of the contest for the Greek mainland and focus on a significant Greek defeat that has had an interesting cultural afterlife. We begin with the decade between the Persian onslaughts, 490 to 480 BC. One of the 10 generals at Marathon was a man named Themistocles. After the death of Miltiades in 489 BC, Themistocles emerged as a leader of energy and vision. The Athenians ran state mines in southeastern Attica that had produced silver and lead for many centuries. In the 480s BC, the mines generated a huge surplus, which the citizenry was inclined to distribute as a per capita cash handout. Themistocles instead convinced the assembly to invest the extra money in building new warships. At the time, Athens was engaged in a war with the nearby island of Aegina, so their need for ships was immediate. Athens already had a navy, but now it perhaps doubled in size to 200 warships. Thucydides praises Themistocles for his foresight, so it may be that Themistocles took this action with a view to a future Persian invasion and used the war with Aegina as a cover. Such manipulation was wholly in character for him, as we shall see. But the result was unquestionable. Athens now became the preeminent naval power in Greece, fitted out with a fleet of the most modern warships. The impact of this Athenian fleet on the Persian invasion of 480 BC was to be decisive, and that also provided the basis for Athenian domination in the Aegean for much of the century. Otherwise, so far as our evidence allows us to see, life in Greece continued as it always had done in the decade between the Persian invasions. States quarrelled, competed, and fought. In 486 BC, Darius died, and the Persian crown passed to his son, Xerxes. A revolt in Egypt diverted Darius from Greece, who died without avenging Marathon. Xerxes took up the torch, but had to first reconquer Egypt, an effort that actually added no new lands to the empire. Since all previous great kings of Persia had extended the realm, he could not be seen to fall short. So Xerxes' intentions on Greece, as stated in Herodotus, was both to punish Athens and to subdue all of Greece, thereby avenging his father's defeat and expanding the empire with one stroke. Thus those who have wronged us will bear the yoke of slavery, as will those who have not, announces the vainglorious and vindictive Xerxes of Herodotus' account. The Persian force was comprised of both land and naval forces of massive size, and typically it was ethnically diverse. Land and sea forces would move in tandem along the north coast of the Aegean and descend into the Greek peninsula hand in hand. Stopping it would require a coordinated naval and land defence of the sort the divided and puny Greek city-states seemed most unlikely to organise. Hopes must have run high in the Persian command. Two reviews of the army were held en route to Greece, at a place called Abydos and another at Doriscus. The second review occasions Herodotus to survey the composition of the Persian forces, and he describes their equipment in detail. In all, he documents no less than 61 nationalities representing 17 or 18 different types of troops. Among them are Ionian and Dorian Greeks from the Persian realms, equipped in the Greek fashion. These reviews have been used to identify a great weakness at the heart of the Persian host. So many different peoples, equipped differently and probably speaking different languages, practically ensured tactical incoherence on the battlefield. This argument, however, displays a deep ignorance of Near Eastern military practice, particularly among the Assyrians. Further, in accounts of the actual fighting to come, it was the Persians, the Medes, and the Sacae from Iran who took part in the main combat. The more exotic contingents were probably window dressing that impressed on the locals the size of the Persian realm. This enormous host, according to Herodotus, ate all the grain and livestock in the lands it passed through and drank entire rivers dry. He later estimates its size at 5,283,220, with the combat troops alone numbering 2,641,610. Clearly, these are preposterous figures. By way of comparison, note that Nazi Germany launched 3 million troops into Russia in 1941 in what is the largest land operation in recorded history. Other ancient sources are a little bit more reasonable, but still quite incredible. 800,000 or 700,000 troops are the sorts of figures that we encounter. But even the 10% of Herodotus's total, the entire Persian force of perhaps 300,000 to 500,000, which would include rowers, logistical support, and other camp followers, would not be entirely impossible. And of this, perhaps 100,000 would be fighting men, a force comparable in size to the Persian armies that later confronted Alexander. 100,000 combat troops still represented an order of magnitude greater than anything even the most populous Greek city-state could put into the field. Compare the 10,000 Athenians at Marathon. As to the Persian fleet, Herodotus gives a figure of 1,207 warships and 3,000 other vessels. This too seems improbably large, but we've no way of being able to estimate its actual size. Whatever the details, the entire Persian force was enormous, and the exaggerated Greek estimates of its numbers only reflect the utter dismay the Greek mind felt in the face of such odds. Xerxes had ordered, some years earlier, that the Hellespont be bridged and a canal be dug through the peninsula of Athos in northern Greece, which was a region then under Persian control. Aside from their practical purpose, these monumental engineering efforts were designed to impress the locals with Persian capabilities and so strike fear into any who were contemplating resistance. In 481 BC, Xerxes moved his royal army to Sardis, the jumping-off point for his invasion. Once more, envoys were dispatched to Greece, demanding earth and water. Pointedly, no such messengers were sent to Athens or Sparta. The army then advanced in three columns across northern Greece. Two incidents during these months illustrate the character of Xerxes and what Greece could expect from their new master should he prevail. The first attempt to bridge the Hellespont was thwarted by a storm. Xerxes ordered the men in charge beheaded and the sea whipped and scolded for defying his will. This last action ranks, alongside Nero's fiddling while Rome burned, as the locus classicus of despotic hubris in antiquity. It also says much about the great king's personality. The second incident shows what Xerxes expected of his subjects. Pythias the Lydian was the richest man in the empire after the king himself. He had approached Xerxes and offered his whole disposable wealth to help fund the war. Xerxes graciously refused and honored Pythias with, of all things, a gift of money. Later, Pythias came to Xerxes again and asked the king a favor in return. Of his five sons, all of whom were enrolled in the king's army, would Xerxes spare Pythias his eldest to look after him in his old age? The king interpreted this request as insolence from a slave he had previously honored, as well as a vote of no confidence in his Greek adventure. He became angry. So he granted Pythias four of his sons, but the eldest and favorite he had cut in two and the halves impaled on either side of the royal road along which the army was marching. Such was the man whose rule the Greeks could look forward to. Meanwhile in Greece, Xerxes' envoys were meeting with great success, probably as a result of the expedition's enormous size. The vast majority of mainland Greek states either Medized or stayed neutral. Out of several hundred polities, only three powerful city-states, Athens, Sparta, and Corinth, resisted the Persian invader. The commemorative monument, later erected by the Greeks at Delphi, listed 31 Greek participants in the war, led by the big three. That represents about 5% of known Greek city-states. In effect, all of Greece down to the borders of Attica had surrendered without a fight. Things were looking bleak. The mood was not improved by ambivalent words from the Delphic oracle. It was standard Greek practice among both private persons and states to consult the famous oracle of Apollo at Delphi before embarking on any important endeavor. Word came back that Athens should trust in her wooden walls, and there were ominous allusions to death at Salamis, an island off the Attic coast. The meaning of the oracle was not immediately clear and has been debated ever since, but Themistocles insisted that the fleet was the city's wooden walls, and that it was the Persians, not the Athenians, who would meet death at Salamis. Convinced and heartened, the Athenian resolve to fight was strengthened by Themistocles' clever interpretation. In the face of the emergency, ongoing internal squabbles were halted and a meeting held. The allies, termed sumachoi, literally those who fight together, took oaths to cement their alliance. The command on both land and sea was probably now decided, and it went to the Spartans the Greek military experts. Spies were sent to Sardis and calls for help issued to non-aligned Greek states. The spies were apprehended at Sardis, but on Xerxes' command, they were sent home unharmed to report the size of the army to the Greeks. The Persians, like the Assyrians, appreciated the value of psychological warfare. The calls for help ended in failure. For many Greeks, local rivalries trumped the national crisis. The people of Argos, for instance, could not overcome their long-standing hatred of the Spartans and now fight alongside them. The allied ambassadors were given until sunset to vacate Argive territory. Envoys arrived at Syracuse on Sicily, arguably the strongest Greek city-state in the whole Greek world. Gelon, its tyrant, promised a massive reinforcement, but on condition that he either command the whole allied force or its naval contingent. The envoys retorted, "We came here not for a commander, but for an army," to which Gelon replied, "Then you'll have plenty of commanders, but you won't have many men for them to command." No help there, nor indeed from any of the states approached. These diplomatic efforts would have occupied the winter of 481 to 480. As spring came around and Xerxes' horde departed Sardis, the defiant states knew they were on their own. A congress was held at the Isthmus of Corinth, and an important strategic decision was made. The Greeks would confront the Persians in the north before they got into the heartland of central Greece. A large force of 10,000 hoplites and 250 warships was sent north to the coastal pass at Tempe, in Thessaly, near Mount Olympus. The Greek trust in this force was as touching as it was callow. It illustrates their inexperience in dealing with major campaigns. Their wars were border disputes between small city-states. They simply could not conceive of what was coming against them, a force probably four times bigger than that faced by the Athenians at Marathon. 10,000 hoplites were not very likely to stop it. As it turned out, Tempe had to be abandoned when it became clear that the Greek position could be easily outflanked. The people of Thessaly, their homeland now fully exposed to the Persians, Medized. After the Tempe debacle, a new congress was held, but the original strategy retained. A land army would hold the narrow pass at Thermopylae, which means hot gates, a natural bottleneck that narrowed to only 50 feet across and had high mountains on one side and the sea on the other. An ancient wall across this pass was rebuilt as a further obstacle. To Thermopylae was sent a Spartan king named Leonidas, with a corps of 300 hand-picked Spartan hoplites and various allies. With the Greek fleet stationed nearby off Cape Artemisium to block a Persian landing in their rear, the Greek army at Thermopylae awaited the arrival of the invader. It was sometime in August, 480 BC. Herodotus provides more detail for this battle than he does for Marathon. The Greek force is enumerated at 300 Spartans, apparently all men with sons, and about 5,900 others, including 400 Thebans. Now, the position of the Thebans in the alliance is most unclear, and Herodotus is unusually hostile toward them, perhaps reflecting bias among his informants. He presents the 400 Thebans as virtual hostages to the allies. Each contingent had its own general, but all of them deferred to Leonidas as the commander-in-chief. Leonidas' force, smaller even than that sent to Tempe, seems risible, but it was supposed to be an advance guard charged with holding the pass until reinforcements arrived. So what was the delay? Why weren't large forces sent up there immediately? Well, the Spartans were yet again delayed by religious commitments, and the rest of the Greeks were celebrating the Olympic Games. It may seem absurd to us today to put an athletic festival in front of national survival, but recall that the ancient Olympic Games honoured Zeus, the father of gods and men. It would not bode well for allied military efforts if Zeus were not properly honoured at one of his chief festivals. To the Greek mind, national survival, in fact, depended on the festival proceeding. The goodwill of the gods was critical to any endeavour. Herodotus, therefore, is quite clear that the defence of Thermopylae was no suicide mission. His interpretation has been challenged by modern scholars who think it rather illogical. Leonidas's tiny army is the main cause for their concern. The promise of reinforcements is described by one author as dust blown in the eyes of the extra Peloponnesian allies. In other words, a vacuous promise. Or perhaps Leonidas's mandate was to delay the Persians on land while the fleet off Artemisium did damage to the Persian armada. If so, this was a holding action, not a definitive stand. These are possibilities, to be sure, but Herodotus is very clear that the Greek alliance planned to stop the entire Persian invasion at Thermopylae. Xerxes approached. A Persian scout was sent ahead to count the Greek numbers and assess their dispositions. Amazed at the tiny force, the scout reported back to the king an even more bizarre detail. The Spartans were all standing about, combing their hair and exercising. Were these men really preparing to fight it out with the royal host? At this point, Herodotus inserts an exchange between Xerxes and the exiled Spartan king Demaratus, who had put himself at the service of the Persian court, where he was honoured and received some Ionian cities to govern. Demaratus is occasionally trotted out by Herodotus to hold imaginary conversations with Xerxes whenever some contrast between Greek and Persian customs requires dramatic emphasis. This is one such occasion. Demaratus had warned Xerxes on a prior occasion not to underestimate the sort of men he was going up against if he attacked Greece. So now Xerxes asked Demaratus whether he was really serious about how dangerous these preening dandies were. Most certainly, replied Demaratus, they were just doing what their custom dictated before risking their lives. In any case, the outcome would show whether he was lying or not. Another tradition has it that Xerxes sent notes to Leonidas demanding that the Spartans give up their arms, to which Leonidas replied, come and get them. After 4 days of waiting, Xerxes enthroned himself on a good vantage point and ordered his core troops, Kissians and Medes, to assault the Greek position at Thermopylae. They were butchered ferociously in the narrow path in a fight that lasted most of the first day. Toward the end of the day, Xerxes withdrew the Medes and sent in his crack troops, the Immortals. They too suffered grievously at the hands of the Greek defenders, who fought a little in front of the wall at the mouth of the narrows. It is noteworthy here that the Greeks used deception on the Persians. They would feign flight, and then, as the Persians chased them and lost cohesion, the Greeks would suddenly wheel and attack. Xerxes leapt from his throne on three occasions during this phase of the fighting, so intense was the engagement. On the second day, the Persians fared no better. The Greeks fought in sequence, each ethnic contingent facing the Persians in turn, so some system of ordered retirement was employed. The details of the combat are passed over in relative silence by Herodotus, but it must have been horrendous. The confined space of these confrontations, where the Persians were channeled onto the narrow Greek front, can only have ensured unimaginable and horrific scenes of butchery in front of the Greek lines. There was no escape for the Persians forced onto the phalanx. They could not flee right or left or to the rear. At the point of contact, the combat would have been purely for survival. This would have made it particularly harrowing and desperate. An excellent evocation of its undoubted hideousness can be gained from Stephen Pressfield's 1998 novel, Gates of Fire. Pressfield powerfully, if imaginatively, portrays the churning crush of the battle, with its cacophony of noise and screams, its welter of spurting blood, spilled intestines, and excrement discharged in terror. It makes for rough reading. Herodotus provides a detail that illustrates the combat's viciousness. At the end, he reports, men were fighting with their fists and teeth. After 2 days of this, the Persian situation did not look good. Many hundreds, perhaps thousands of the king's men had been slaughtered and the Greeks were still holding their position. What to do? Betrayal saved Xerxes. The traitor was Ephialtes of Malus, who was later reviled by his compatriots and came to a bad end. Ephialtes showed Xerxes a mountain path that circumvented the strong Greek position. It could be flanked. Now the Greeks knew of this path and had sent a contingent of 1,000 Phocians to guard it. The Persian immortals, however, set out at night and, coming upon the Phocians, assailed them and drove them in confusion up the heights and so out of the action. The immortals then pressed on their way. The Greeks were made aware of the Persian turning maneuver, but how so was not made clear, perhaps Persian deserters or Persian prisoners, and they held a council to discuss what to do. Leonidas and the Spartans insisted on staying and doing their duty to the end. The others either went home or were sent home. The reason for the Spartan decision to stay is not obvious. Herodotus says Leonidas stayed in response to an oracle promising either the destruction of Sparta or the death of one of its kings. This is very convenient and smacks of later justificatory composition. The later Spartan reputation for not abandoning their posts stems from this very action at Thermopylae, so it can't have been the reason for Leonidas's decision now. Perhaps the Spartans stayed to give their escaping allies maximum time to get away. Whatever their reasons, the Spartans were joined by the Thespians. The Thebans, says Herodotus, were forced to stay. This seems highly unlikely. Why make a bad situation worse by having to rely on potentially disloyal Confederates? Why waste needed manpower guarding them? In all likelihood, the Thebans in fact chose to stay. The third day at Thermopylae ranks as one of the most famous conflicts in the annals of military history, up there with Pickett's charge at Gettysburg or the Battle of Waterloo. The reputation is well earned. Herodotus probably enjoyed access to Greek survivors, perhaps also Ionian Greek witnesses on the Persian side, for what happened next. So we need not be so sceptical as to think his whole account was made up. On this final day, Leonidas led the remainder of his tiny force out to a wider spot in front of the Narrows. He's likely to have done so because he believed that this position afforded a better opportunity for killing Persians in large numbers than had the confines of the pass. And so it transpired. I note, in passing, that this tactical detail perhaps supports the open order model of hoplite combat over the standard model of tight pack scrimmaging, as we discussed in Lecture 9. In order to do maximum damage, Leonidas needed more space. As the Spartans occupied this forward position, someone said to Dionysius, the man that Herodotus deemed the bravest of the Spartans at Thermopylae, that the Persians were so numerous that their arrows would block out the sun. To which Dionysius replied, "Fine, we'll fight in the shade." The fighting started at about 10 a.m. Xerxes once more launched a frontal assault, this time knowing that the Greek rear would soon be attacked. The scene of carnage at the mouth of the Narrows was again frightful. Persian troops were whipped into battle, trampled each other, and some pitched off the cliffs into the sea. The Greeks, certain of death, fought like madmen. Leonidas fell, and a fierce struggle developed over his body. I note, by the way, that Herodotus denotes this fight as an athysmos polos. Clearly, in this context, athysmos cannot mean physical shoving of phalanx against phalanx, but something vaguer, like a major struggle or a serious fight. Later, at Plataea, by the way, he also makes mention of an athysmos between the Persians and the Greeks, and the latter, of course, did not fight in a phalanx, so athysmos can mean something other than massed physical shove. By now, the Persians who had taken the path were coming up from the rear, so the Spartans and allies who were left retired to a hillock and there fought to the last man. It was now that some of them, having lost their weapons, used their fists and teeth. Calculating casualties is a difficult matter. Herodotus says that 20,000 Persians fell, which seems excessive. He also says that Xerxes concealed these dire losses from the rest of his army by secretly burying all but 1,000 of the corpses, and that he heaped up 4,000 Greek dead to be viewed by the Persian sailors, summoned from Artemisium. Even if precision proves elusive, we may reasonably imagine several thousand Greek dead, and given the nature of the fighting and the terrain on which it took place, significantly greater losses on the Persian side. 8,000 to 10,000 would not be an impossible guess, but it is a guess, and among them were several brothers of Xerxes. Given the size of the Persian force, the victory here cannot be described as pyrrhic, but it was certainly very costly. While all this was underway on land, off Cape Artemisium, the Greek fleet fought three indecisive engagements with the Persian forces. We shall say a little more about this facet of the Thermopylae campaign in the next lecture when we discuss naval warfare in slightly more detail. But we do note that the Persian sailors, principally Phoenicians and Egyptians, were proving more of a match for the Greeks than their counterparts in the land army. When news of the fall of Thermopylae arrived, the Greek fleet withdrew south. The defeat at Thermopylae was a serious blow to the Greek war effort. Persian forces now enjoyed free rein in central Greece. Athens lay open to the invader, whose expertise in siegecraft ensured that the city would fall, even if it was defended. In the event, the city was evacuated. From Thermopylae, the Persian army could make it to the border of Attica within about a week. This is far too short a time frame for the transport of perhaps 250,000 men, women, and children from Athens to safe havens in the Peloponnese or on the island of Salamis, especially when so many Athenian ships and rowers were with the fleet at Artemisium. So the evacuation had probably been initiated as a precaution before Thermopylae took place. With their future uncertain, the Athenians abandoned their city to the barbarian, and the Greek alliance awaited the Persians' arrival on its doorstep. Once the war had been won, the events at Thermopylae were reinterpreted into a glorious defeat, the first in the long tradition of romanticized military reverses. The glorious defeat is a phenomenon whereby what is really an abject military disaster is transformed into something noble and valuable. The genre has several elements which can be mixed and matched as needed. Usually, the gloriously defeated are underdogs who find themselves in the tough position. This is true of the Spartans at Thermopylae, the besieged Jewish rebels at Masada in AD 73, who we'll be looking at in Lecture 20, the defenders of the Alamo in 1836, or the surrounded British at Dunkirk in 1940. Desperate straits is the essential element of the glorious defeat here. Usually, the enemy are the aggressors, and the glorious defeat is a defensive action. Not all narratives in the genre display this feature. The Battle of Little Bighorn, for instance, in 1876, formerly Custer's last stand until recent reinterpretation removed it from the ledger of glorious defeats entirely, was actually an act of aggression. Custer was seeking out the Lakota to exterminate them. Similarly, at the time of the Battle of Gettysburg in 1863, which is a totemic example of the glorious defeat, Lee was invading the North. In both cases, of course, a defensive veneer can be glossed on to the action. Custer was seeking to protect white settlers from Indian attacks, or Lee was defending a way of life that had been attacked in 1861. These dubious arguments emphasize that usually the gloriously defeated are defenders. It adds great luster to a glorious defeat if the underdogs have the option to save themselves but choose the nobler path, that is, dying to a man. The preferred mode is for the gloriously defeated to go down, taking as many of the enemy with them as possible. Again, not all glorious defeat narratives have this feature of choice, but there can be little doubt that the power of the story is enhanced by the underdogs rejecting safety in favour of staying the course and going down swinging. Also, most glorious defeats are inscribed in the annals of the eventual victors in the wider struggles that they are a part of. The true power of the glorious defeat genre lies in what the events are believed to reveal about valued group characteristics. Invariably, the defeat celebrates honored traits, commitment to valued goals such as honor or national identity, a willingness to sacrifice self for the collective goal, valor, steadfastness, and courage in the face of overwhelming odds, and ancillary traits such as skill at arms, perseverance, discipline, and devotion to duty. This is how the real circumstances of a glorious defeat are transformed into no defeat at all and become instead a moral victory. The main elements of the glorious defeat narrative were established by the Battle of Thermopylae. The process of reinterpretation started almost immediately with the battle's commemoration by the Greeks themselves. The epitaph of the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae, composed by the poet Simonides, who lived between 556 and 468 BC, heralds the key elements in the fully developed tradition. And the epitaph is, "Go tell the Spartans, traveller, that here we lie, obedient to their orders." The Spartan ethos is now defined primarily as staying at one's post at all costs. All, or at least all but one, as we shall see, chose to do so. The epitaph thus puts widely admired national characteristics of the Spartans at centre stage, namely strict obedience and devotion to duty, and celebrates their display in the context of what was really a pretty catastrophic reverse. Herodotus' account of the battle closes with some anecdotes that further illuminate how the events at Thermopylae were reinterpreted shortly after they had occurred. Two Spartans, Eurytus and Aristodemus, were off the line due to eye infections. On the last day, Eurytus armed himself and joined the last stand, helped to his place in the ranks by a servant. Aristodemus, in contrast, stayed outside the combat zone and later returned safe and sound to Sparta. There, Eurytus was celebrated, and Aristodemus, in his own lifetime, shunned by his compatriots. My favourite moment, however, is when Herodotus once more wheels out Demaratus. Xerxes first commends Demaratus for having told him the truth about Spartan military prowess in their earlier conversation. The king then asks, "Tell me, how many more are there like the ones who fell here? And how may I go about defeating them?" These questions say it all. They show that Xerxes, for all his external power and majesty, is inwardly afraid. His moral vacuity is stressed when a few sections later, he orders Leonidas's head to be cut off and stuck on a pole. Herodotus expressly comments that this act went against the Persian custom of honoring valiant adversaries. What else can the reader think than that Xerxes is a moral midget who cannot abide even by his own people's sense of decency? A defeat at the hands of such a man is no defeat at all.